I'm Marcus Hutton, actor for 40 years and voice artist for over 30 years. I'm also chair of the Equity Audio Committee, and I've been advocating for performers' rights, particularly in the AI space, for the past few years.
I'm Dr. Mathilde Pavy. I'm a lawyer and an expert in intellectual property, AI and ethics.
I'm Annette Rizzo, a broadcaster, university lecturer, voiceover and activist of long experience, but rather lighter on legal expertise. It's my job to ask the basic questions so no one else has to. You're welcome.
Welcome to the Last Human Voice podcast, exploring the moral, legal and ethical issues in artificial intelligence in the creative sectors and in performance synthesis.
We'll be focusing on the legal rights and protections available to artists and performers.
And looking at how AI affects us all, down to the very last human voice. In this episode, we review the AI deal that ended the actors' strike in the United States.
So let's place the deal within the context of the strike. On the 14th of July 2023, the American Actors Union, SAG-AFTRA, went on strike over a labor dispute with the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, also known as the AMPTP. On the 9th of November, the strike was suspended because an interim agreement between the union and AMPTP had been found. The interim agreement was put to a vote by the members of SAG-AFTRA to approve or reject. The deal was approved by SAG-AFTRA members on the 5th of December 2023 by a majority of approximately 78%, or 78.33% to be exact. The vote officially ended the strike.
Now that's for the timeline. We should also point out that the SAG-AFTRA strike followed and happened alongside another important strike in Hollywood, a strike led by staff writers. TV and film writers are represented in the US by the Writers Guild of America, WGA for short, who went on strike slightly before actors and did it on very similar complaints, pay, working conditions, and AI. The two strikes combined brought Hollywood to a standstill for months. The total impact of the strike was estimated to reach $6.5 billion, according to journalists. And of course, that standstill also impacted creative workers in film and TV located outside the US, because many US productions are made in different parts of the world. And you, Marcus, I think, were impacted by the strike, weren't you? Even though you're working primarily out of the UK.
Yes, I was. Yes, I was filming an episode of a Netflix drama, big series. And I'd done one block and was due to go back for a second block to complete a sequence. But the strike was called before we got to film it. So that was, July. So this was a big number. You know, there were hundreds of supporting artists in the sequence I was doing. There were crew, 5 camera crews and lighting and catering and everything else, main cast. And it was being filmed in a central London location, huge one, very famous. Can't say what it was, but it was massive. So, I mean, there were millions of pounds being spent and all those jobs, of course. And I only went back and finished filming that sequence last week. So it was surreal to have a 6-month break between shots, as it were. Now, and it's because some of the main cast in that show were SAG-AFTRA members, so even though Equity members were not on strike, the production was halted, which was very frustrating, but obviously our concerns on this side of the pond are very much the same as for US actors and writers, so we watched to see how it played out with bated breath.
Both writers and actors went on strike in the US to secure increased compensation for their work in line with inflation. They wanted improved working conditions. And here we go. They wanted protections, funnily enough, for artificial intelligence. And that's what we're really going to focus on this time. We're looking at the deal that the actors, obviously represented by SAG-AFTRA, have reached with the big studios. And we're going to focus on the parts of the deal which relate specifically to AI. So let's see what the actors in the US have ended up saying yes to just before Christmas.
Now, this deal is important because SAG-AFTRA is the first union to set rates and terms for protection on AI with this contract. This, combined with the fact that US productions dominate content production around the world today, means that the terms of this deal could well become new industry norms worldwide. So having a grasp on what the deal includes is not only important for US actors and producers, but it is also relevant to performers and filmmakers outside America.
Now, let's see what's in the 2023 contract, which is sort of the shorthand name or nickname for the agreement. But before we start, we want to be clear that we are reading and learning about the content of the deal just like you are, in the sense that we're looking at the information that's published online by SAG-AFTRA and looking at the materials that they've made available to understand what those terms mean and what they would look like in practice. The documents we've looked at are marked as interim and draft, so potentially subject to changes. So we need to keep an eye out for those, although we wouldn't expect any changes to be substantial because the text has been voted on by all parties. So with this in mind, we want to stress we have no special insights or insider knowledge on how the negotiations went and how the text should be interpreted where it's not clear already as it is on the page. And so we also recommend that you go and read the deal for yourself, although of course listen to us and you'll get a digest, which hopefully will help you navigate the document a little bit more easily. The terms are published in full, they're summarized in a document. There are FAQs available as well to help some of the more technical sections. And if you think we got something wrong, tell us, get in touch and we'll look at it again and work it out with you.
Okay, well, let's start with the scope of the agreement. Now, this deal is an amendment or an update, if you'd like, of two key collective agreements or contracts, nicknamed the television theatrical contracts, their actual technical name being slightly different. Now, this means that the protections achieved on AI apply to acting work delivered in the context of, and I quote, theatrical motion pictures and scripted dramatic content produced for television and new media platforms. So what this means is the new deal on AI is limited to performances for TV and film work, motion pictures, distributed through the usual channels, as well as more recent online platforms like Netflix and so on. This new deal does not extend to all acting work which may be impacted or enhanced by AI in the context of, say, video games, mobile phone apps, audio-only work like telephone prompts, audiobooks and so forth.
So there's a lot that's kind of not covered, not in there. The deal does cover the use of AI to make alterations of an actor's performance, which it calls digital alterations in the text, and the use of AI to create digital clones of actors in motion pictures, and these it calls digital replicas. We're going to start with digital alterations because they are slightly more straightforward than digital replicas, slightly. We should also stress that the deal provides different provisions depending on whether the performer acts as principal performer in the motion picture or as a background actor. This distinction is more relevant to the protection on digital replications, but it is worth keeping in mind for now. Okay, so digital alterations made with AI. What does it say about them, Marcus?
Well, the rules appear to be the same for principal performers and background actors or supporting artists on digital alterations. The golden rule is consent. Now, the performer's consent is required to digitally alter a performer's performance in either the photography or soundtrack previously recorded by the performer. The consent must be clear and conspicuous. And it seems the deal requires the consent to be recorded in writing through, and I quote, an endorsement or statement in the performer's employment contract that is separately signed or initiated by the performer or in a separate writing that is signed by the performer. Here, I think the union is trying to avoid any practice or attempt at hiding consent declarations in the small print, which is a practice we've seen in relation to other technologies in the past. Yes, we certainly have seen that. So it's got to be sort of expressly written down and not buried. The deal adds that consent given for alterations before the performer's death will continue after their death, unless otherwise stated. So if the performer is no longer alive, alterations can be approved by their relatives or the union if the relatives can't be found.
Now, there are several exceptions that apply to the conditional, the golden rule of consent for the alteration of a performance. The first exception is that the performer's consent is not required when the photography or the soundtrack of that performance remains substantially, emphasis added, as scripted, performed or recorded. And we may have a chat about that. Exception number two And that's building on the first one. There's also no need to get the consent of the actor if the alterations are made in post-production for the purposes of editing, arranging, revising, manipulating photography, soundtrack, things like to create cosmetics, wardrobe, nose reduction, timing, speed, pitch, tone, clarity, adding visual effects, etc., etc. You catch my drift. And that also includes, actually, adjustment in dialogue and narration or narration. So that's the first two exceptions. Let's look at the third. There is no need to seek the performer's consent to modify that performance if it is for the purposes of dubbing or using a double when that's allowed under other pre-existing collective agreements. Fourth exception, there is no need to seek the performer's consent to modify that performance in order to adjust their lip, facial or body movement and make that sync with the voice when it is dubbed in another language. And in the same vein, there's also no need to get the performer's consent if their lips, face or body movement is modified in order to adjust it to new dialogues or new photography in order to meet the needs of a particular market. So finally, this right to alter the performance with the consent of the performer and using AI technology doesn't change or expand upon provisions applicable to nudity. Now, that's for the rules on alterations to a performance made with AI. What do we think, team? We have one golden rule, but 4 to 5 exceptions. Is it a case of the exceptions prove the rule of consent? Or do we think that we are emptying or carving out, creating big carve-outs in that rule? What do you think, Annette?
Well, I've got a question straight away, really, which is, and this refers to something that Marcus said a while back now. And I know that it's saying that they can't change, make any changes to the performance as, you know, as long as it remains substantially as scripted. You said something a while ago, Marcus, which was about wanting control over, let's say, you know, you might in the course of a performance envision, because this is not something of which I have any experience, be concerned about them even so much as raising an eyebrow, because that actually alters your performance. It's a tiny adjustment, but actually that does, who's judging what's substantial? Is raising an eyebrow substantial? And I suspect you, Marcus, might say yes in the performance that you've given, whereas somebody in post-production might say, nah, just raised an eyebrow.
Yeah, that is a worry. I mean, it does seem to sort of say in exception 4, if their lips, face or body is a result of adjusting dialogues or photographs. I mean, what's more concerning is that, you know, is that little script changes, there are all sorts of little nuances that happen, you know, little sort of performance changes happen, little bits of dialogue get changed on the fly. And this is just like another... This is permission to mess about with that in post. And I think this is going to cause some problems here. Exception 3, no need to seek the performer's consent to modify their performance. Now, that isn't a new clause. That's in a pact contract as well, the UK contract. However, this clause has caused mayhem around the world. I mean, I'm in touch with United Voice Artists, who are a kind of coalition of voiceover guilds and unions around the world. I think they've got sort of, there's a lot of countries involved, maybe 35, 40 unions and guilds involved in that. And of course, what this means is that they're stuffed. I mean, they're, you know, there's in Asia, Spain, Italy, Germany, they're all over Europe. There are dubbing communities that just dub drama, and this effectively could put them out of work. I mean, I noticed that UVA started a campaign after the SAG strike deal came out, called Real Dubbing, Real Humans, and they started a petition, and it's had over 110,000 signatures the last time I looked, which, you know, that kind of shows that this is not just a niche concern. There's a lot of people interested enough in dubbing to actually bother to sign something and protest about it. So I think the knock-on, going back to what you said earlier, Matilda, the knock-on of SAG contracts on the rest of the world, because America's such a huge production hub, is something that there have been complaints about this in the past, that SAG sort of just considers its own members. Of course, perhaps it should, but I do wonder if there needs to be more joined up thinking with other unions and associations.
They must feel thrown under the bus, for want of a better phrase.
Yeah, they do. That's exactly the expression they've used, that they feel that SAG threw them under the bus.
You're talking about the exception to the performer's consent to alter their performance in the context of dubbing. So just to be clear, how does that impact the work of the voiceover after? If we're making the voice better fit the face, isn't it good for everyone, or am I missing like a real dynamic?
Well, these new technologies means you can take the actual actor's voice and just make it speak another language. That's one of the things it can do. But, you know, I mean, you wonder, could they have pushed for their kind of fellow artists around the world and said, yeah, you can have consent to dub my voice as long as another human being does the dubbing? But they haven't attempted to put those protections in place because maybe they would have got thrown out. But that's something I think other dubbing artists around the world would have liked to have seen, that SAG was doing something to protect other jobs.
So what was the pushback was on the fact that if you allow any alteration for dubbing combined with cloning that actor's voice into another language to make it speak another language, then you're opening
AI.
Yeah, you're blowing up a huge part of acting work, which is dubbing.
Yeah, I mean, thousands of people around the world, thousands of studios and facilities around the world that are set up are just dedicated to this particular thing. You know, some studios are just highly specialist dubbing places, and I think it's a bit of a hand grenade to have thrown in suddenly to potentially wipe out a sector.
Yeah, so it's not just the voice actors, it's everybody, it's the engineers, it's everybody else who works in those production
companies. Yeah, everybody,
companies.
Yeah.
That's a lot of jobs.
And do we think those jobs will be repurposed or redistributed in AI? I think that's often the argument.
Well, I saw a post from a sound engineer the other day. He just said, look, if we haven't got any actors to record, we haven't got a job. I think they rightfully should be angry. We talk about actors all the time. Yvonne said this, didn't she, in the episode that we did recently. But we talk about actors all the time. But there's lots of other people who are affected by this.
Well, as you saw on your Netflix production as well,
yeah.
And I know that was they were affected by the strike, but a lot of those jobs will go if there's no human-centred production.
Yeah.
The same goes for post-production work.
Yeah, and the level of skill, you know, I mean, just something small, you know, like, I mean, there was, you know, on that production, I was walking around this big building we were filming in, and there was just one company who specialised in providing sunlight. So they have massive lamps on massive cranes and, you know, a whole crew that goes with them. And they were on all four sides of this building. So, I mean, goodness knows, you know, tens of thousands of watts of lighting and very, very expensive equipment. And I thought, well, if through, you know, AI sort of lighting technologies and stuff and camera, these jobs are all in danger. We've said before, it's a very entrepreneurial business. People set up, you know, industries within the industry to service the industry, and things can change overnight, and something like a union agreement can impact that in a blink, you know. So mind you, there hadn't been a strike like this since 1960, so it's not like actors go on strike all the time or writers go on strike all the time. These are all big questions.
Yeah, and then to me, this part of the deal on AI-made alterations to performance effectively creates what in other countries outside the US we know as more rights for the performance, because the US doesn't have any more rights. Well, although the Obama government did sign on to the Beijing Treaty, which would force the US to introduce more rights for performances recorded in audiovisual content, it's not happened because at the time the signature took place, Obama lost the House for lots of political reasons that didn't come through. AI comes along, and now what we're seeing in this deal is that there is no modification to happen without the consent of the performer when it's substantially different, I suppose, when it's taking the performance somewhere else. Now, the question, big question, is what does that mean? We could make educated guess by looking at what courts and parties have thought in relation to more rights would be an infringement of the performer's more right for damaging or prejudicing the reputation of the performer and the quality of the performance. but that would be a big guess. And it would take something really extreme to modify that. And I don't think raising an eyebrow, for example, in law under moral rights would activate the right of integrity. I'm not saying it's right. I think it's perceived very much as a last resort type protection. And I don't know if that's the case in this deal as well, or whether it's looking at, you know, regulating and enforcing better and good practice for the quality of the content and also for the collaboration. Like, you'd like to have trust and collaboration between director, producers, editors and the performers. And the performer probably wants to know that their performance is not going to be widely manipulated in post-production without being involved or being asked. So it'll be interesting to watch that space and see what happens. But now, turning to the other big component of the deal, let's look at digital clones or replicas, because that's the language used in the 2023 contracts. And here we have a slight difference in treatment and level of protections depending on whether the performer is a principal actor or a background actor. And the deal differentiates between the two. So I will just simply define background actors as those performers without speaking lines. It's a little bit of a shortcut, but I think that will keep things clear for us for the purpose of this discussion. So let's start with principal performers and the protections within the 2023 deals for the use of replicas, digital replicas made with AI or equivalent technologies for that category of actors. Now, another distinction that the deal makes, and stay with me, so you have the difference between a principal actor and a background actor. Put that to one side, that'll be relevant in a second. Now, the second category that the deal makes and the second distinction is one where the digital replica was created in the context of employment for a particular project between the performer and the production. So that those are known as employment-based replicas, and they're subject to one set of rules. And separate from that, the deal recognizes that there may be digital replicas that have been created independently. That means independently from a specific project, specific film, specific series, particular production. So here, the replica, we assume, the deal doesn't say, but would be owned or controlled by the performer, another studio, another agencies, and those are known as independently created replicas. We're going to look at the rules applicable to either types of replicas because they're actually quite important. And at this point, I hand over to Annette.
So the definition then of employment-based replicas, according to the deal. So here we go. An employment-based replica is a replica of the voice or likeness of the performer that is created A, in connection with employment on a motion picture under this agreement, B, using digital technology, C, with the performer's physical participation, and D, is for the purpose of portraying the performer in photography or soundtrack in which the performer did not actually perform. Now, there are conditions applicable to the creation of the replica in the first place and conditions applicable to the use of the replica after that. So for the creation of the replica, the performer needs to be told 48 hours in advance if they need to be on set for the purpose of creating a replica, today being recorded or scanned. The performer needs to consent. There we go, clear and conspicuous consent, following the same requirement we've detailed in relation to digital alteration. The consent should be recorded in writing. Then the time spent making the digital replica is to be compensated like any other work rendered by the performer. So for the use of the replica, here come the rules. Rule number one, consent. The use also requires consent. So here we have a two-part consent, one for the creation and one for the use. The request for consent to use the replica needs to come with a sufficiently detailed description of the intended use. Well, surely that's a win. The consent to use the replica should be recorded in writing, as described earlier for the digital alterations. And consent granted during a performer's lifetime continues after their death unless explicitly limited otherwise. Again, in the absence of consent given during the lifetime of the performer, the performer's estate can provide that consent, or the union can if the estate can't be located. And then rule number two, so we've done consent, now we're on compensation. The performer needs to be paid a pro rata of their daily rate, at least the minimum level of pay set by collective agreements, whichever is the higher, for the number of production days, hope you're keeping up with this, for the number of production days that the production determines the performer would have been required to work had the performer actually performed the scenes in person. And this is actually quite an important detail of the deal. We're going to come back to this. So the producer needs to calculate the estimate in good faith using the following objective criteria. And that's my first question is, what are those objective criteria? Because the text of the deal doesn't actually say this, does it? Any compensation received for the use of the replica is to be treated as wages, and that's as opposed to residuals, for example. No compensation is required if the performer has already received compensation for the project, which would cover the activity had it been performed by the performer in person. And I'm a bit befuddled by that one. I think I'd need to kind of have an example or more information because I'm not really sure what that is intended to cover. No compensation is required if the replica is used in a scene which was also performed by the performer in person. The use of the digital replica will attract residuals if it is used in content which would make the performer eligible for residuals. There's a lot of there's nodding. Matilde's nodding and Marcus is humming. The digital replica can be used by the producer for content going beyond the initial project, like a spin-off, for example, but there needs to be new consent and compensation respecting the minimum rates of the deal or another equivalent agreement if the replica is taken into a different output, like a video game or it could be a commercial, something like that. And last but not least, digital replicas are not to be used to circumvent the employment of performers, including background actors. This is a commitment which is expressly made in the deal, like the commitment to act and bargain in good faith. So I'm hoping that this kind of a commitment is enough to protect the actors involved. What I don't really understand, how will they hold producers accountable? Are they going to keep track of the headcount of performers on every production? How's that going to work? I don't know. Maybe we kind of could do with some clarification on that. But those are the main points for the creation and use of employment-based replicas. So after all the head nodding and humming, what do you think?
Yes, I'm very curious about what this objective criteria is. I think it's a bit tempting for producers here to put their thumb on the scale when they're making these sorts of calculations, like a dishonest grocer. Well, this is an interesting one. Last but not least, digital replicas are not to be used to circumvent the employment of performers, including background actors. Well, what's the point in having the technology then? I cannot see that there's... The bargain in good faith. I mean, the technology is designed to do exactly that. It's a cost-cutting efficiency tool, and I think this is padding. Although it's there, and I suppose it could be contested.
It's really interesting to see it because they're basically seeing or trying to frame AI as this additional tool in the toolbox. They don't want it to replace performers, and they're working quite hard at creating those safeguards. But there is going to be an element of replacement. I mean, as you say, that's the point. I'm really curious to see what the business model of it all, what the ecosystem of a production is going to look like with AI being really embedded in as a mainstream tech in the same way that we had computer generated imaging. Now, do you remember whether CGI attracted the same criticism or not? Or was it because it was so expensive and to an extent slow that we didn't get such a concern for labor replacement?
Well, I think the thing, when you think about CGI, I mean, I suppose, you know, a friend of mine who's a scriptwriter said that, you know, in the olden days, the fastest way not to get your film made was to write a sentence that started, "And the Spanish Armada appears on the horizon." because the cost of that is absolutely prohibitive. But obviously, CGI did allow the Spanish Armada to appear on the horizon. And I think we're very, very embedded. When it comes to essays, you know, I think the business of hiring 100 supporting artists, whereas you might have employed 1,000 in the past, and then, you know, there's been technology that doubled them, and, you know, the bodies behave in the way that you know, there's all sorts of clever computer programs that do all of that. So I don't think that's the problem. But what seems to be the problem for me here is that you can, you know, you create a digital double, background artist or whatever, and you can make them almost into a character. They can appear in lots of scenes. You can move them around. I just don't know. I mean, it seems to me that AI technology is absolutely designed to circumvent the employment of performers, including background actors. That is its sole purpose. Yes, it doesn't mean that background artists and actors are not going to be employed, but they're going to be employed in less volume. That is clearly what's coming. So I don't really know. And the objective criteria thing, I don't know who makes that call? What is, you know, bargaining in good faith, objectivity? They all seem to be loose terms.
I mean, on that one, I can only imagine that when the producer is going to estimate that, they are going to assume performers have been one take wonders, right? They're not going to assume, well, this scene is likely to be difficult and we needed to take it 25 times, 30 times, I don't know, before it goes. I would imagine we're going to see a kind of a productivity and efficiency culture in how time is estimated between the actual person who would have done it with their body on set versus their digital replicas which will get it perfectly instantly. Maybe they'll use lines, maybe they will use like minutes or seconds on screen, but we know that for minutes on screen, hours of shooting have happened first.
Well,
right?
Yeah, I heard an animation director talk about this the other day. He said, look, when you try and do these sort of time and motion contracts, you know, people need to come in, they need to sit down, they need to say hello. Goodness me, they might even have a cup of coffee for 5 minutes and have a little chat before they start work. But you trim all that fat out of it. And exactly. So I can't see that it's ever going to match the real time. And it's very, very prescriptive.
It's funny you should say that because I was shown a potential contract. I don't think the person involved signed, but it was actually something that was asking for somebody to contribute to the making of a clone of their voice. But amongst the conditions, one was, I'm making up the times now, but it was something like 2 hours of work. You know, you will be paid for 2 hours of work. And part of what was built in was basically if it takes 2.5 hours, we're still only going to pay you for 2 hours. And what's that? And that is exactly what you're saying. That from their side, I suppose they're saying, well, you know, you should be able to do it in 2 hours. If you go over 2 hours, clearly you're not very good at your job. And that's what they're cutting out. But that's how they're also able to manipulate people. Well, this should be 2 hours. They say objectively, so we pay you for 2 hours. And if it takes longer, that's your fault.
And some people are slower than others. Some people are very quick. You know, I know that there are people who do audiobooks. There are some very brilliant audiobook narrators who can record an hour's worth of content in an hour and a quarter. And there are others who might take 4 hours to do that. You know,
but the result is very human. Just taking extra time doesn't mean you've been bad at your job. Sometimes, and we've all done this, sometimes a job may go a little longer because you do something and it doesn't quite work. Not because you're not good at your job, but because something else clicks and you say, actually, you've been directing me or we've been talking it through this way. And actually, I think maybe if we try it this way and you do it a different way, well, that takes longer, but it works better. And you get something that's a bit more kind of rich and more fully rounded as a final outcome. Well, that takes time.
Yeah, this is piecework, old-fashioned Victorian feudal picking turnips in the field piecework. Or, you know, factory work.
Yeah. It's true that the risk of using a digital replica to make scenes, and obviously I think the deal is premised on the fact, it seems to me, that use or resorting to those tools is exceptional, is the exception, not the norm. But we don't know that, right? We may go into a future where some films have 50% protein, I want to call it protein, in-person performance, and 50% digital clone of that person, who knows? And then we really have a question of the collaboration. Like, are you collaborating with a performer when you're using their digital clones instead of them, right? And what is that going to look like in the future? It's a big question. I'm really surprised to see that it's the producer who makes that good faith estimate, and not to see the performer and the producer will agree on the good faith estimate between themselves, or the casting director, or someone who has another kind of input or perspective than the producer and the budget as a result, because the producer is budget holding. It's part of the job. It's not an easy one, but that gives them a lot of power at the same time. I was a bit surprised to see that tilted so much in favor of the production companies on that one. Anyway, I want to contrast what we've just discussed with the rules applicable to independently created digital replicas. However, we're going to be going on for almost an hour and a half, so I think we should keep that for a second part and do another episode on this topic, and so we can take and spend proper time to discuss the nuances that the deals created between employment-based digital replicas and independently created replicas, because I think we are going to see interesting market dynamics as a result of the two digital replicas being treated differently in the deal.
Great idea.
So what we're actually saying is we need a sequel.
Yes.
I think so. I think otherwise, otherwise it's going to be very, very long. But absolutely, I think, the independent replica stuff I'm fascinated by. This is literally your digital double that you send out for work in your absence, or even if you're dead, presumably. So.
Yep. It would be digital replica for rentals, kind of. Like, we would see like a clone rental market, like we can rent tuxedos, I don't know. And we're also going to talk about the synthetic performers and the extent the deal does not really cover the question of training on content created by performers, whether it is to generate cloning technologies or whether it's to get another gain and develop completely different services or products, etc., but still using, I think, the assets, the talents, the skills, the time of performers, and perhaps that deserves licensing and remuneration and consent. So lots more to talk about.
So a cliffhanger. If you have a question about the deal, or if you think we've missed something crucial, then get in touch. You can find us on Instagram or Twitter or X or whatever you want to call it. We are searchable as @LHVpodcast.
And as usual, we are discussing and sharing thoughts with the view to inform debates and critically reflect on what is going on with AI. This is not to be taken as legal or other professional advice, but hopefully you find it interesting and it keeps your brains going on the topic of AI.
And now, something to prove that we are indeed human voices. That'd be quite funny, wouldn't it, if it turned out that this whole series was in fact three clones.
The twist no one expected.
Which ChatGPT had written all of the scripts. It was the best. Oh dear, excuse me. Look, I'm a real human with a cold. So yes, let's prove that we're human voices, and you can hear us messing up some takes. Here we go.
Whether you're using... Oh, I'll take that again.
Nicknamed the television theatrical contract.
Now we're going to start with digital alter...
The performer's consent is required to digitally alter a
No, I'll take that again because I'm getting lost.
Then do get in... Oh, stay that one again.
Oh, I don't know how to round this off.